went into the cell with a paper bag full of baked sweet potatoes. I brought you a little something. Jefferson was sitting on the bunk with his hands clasped together. I put the bag beside him on the bunk and sat down. I could hear the radio on the floor against the wall playing a sad cowboy song. I saw the notebook and pencil on the floor next to the radio. This was my first visit since I'd given him the notebook and pencil, and I could see that the lead on the pencil was worn down to the wood. I could also see that he had used the eraser a lot. We were quiet a while. Hungry?
Maybe later.
I see you've been writing. Personal, or can I look at it?
If you want.
I got the notebook and came back to the bunk. The fellow on the radio was saying what a beautiful day it was in Baton Rouge. Jefferson had filled 3/4 of the first page. The letters were large and awkward, the way someone would write who could barely see. He had written across the lines instead of above them. He had used the eraser so much that in some places the paper was worn through. Nothing was capitalized and there was no punctuation marks. The letters were thin at the beginning, but became broader as the lead was worn down. As close as I could figure, he had written, "I dreamt it again last night. They were taking me somewhere. I wasn't crying. I wasn't begging. I was just going, going with them. Then I woke up. I couldn't go back to sleep. I didn't want to go back to sleep. I didn't want to dream no more." There was lots of erasing. Then he wrote, "If I ain't nothing but a hog, how come they just don't knock me in the head like a hog? Stab me like a hog." More erasing. Then, "Man walk on 2 foots, hogs on 4 hooves. The last couple of words were barely visible because the lead had been worn all the way to the wood. I read it over a second time before closing the notebook. I didn't know what to say to him.
"When's Easter?"
"Tomorrow is Good Friday."
"That's when he rose?"
"No, he rose on Easter."
"That's when he died. Never said a mumbling word." "That's right. Not a word."
"Did you talk to Reverend Ambrose when he came to visit you?"
"Son, he told me to pray."
"Do you?"
"No."
"It would be good for your nana." He looked at me. His eyes were large and sad and reddened.
"You think I'm going to heaven?"
"I don't know."
"You think Mr. Gropey went to heaven? You think Brother and Bear went to heaven?"
"I don't know."
"Then what I'm going to pray for?"
"For your nana."
"Nana don't need me to help her get to heaven. She'll make it, if it's up there."
"She wants you there with her, where there's no pain and no sorrow." He grinned at me, a brief, cynical grin.
"You pray, Mr. Wiggins?"
"No, Jefferson, I don't." "But then I'm lost, Jefferson. At this moment, I don't believe in anything, like your nana does, like Reverend Ambrose does. And like I want you to believe. I want you to believe so that one day maybe I will."
"In heaven, Mr. Wiggins?"
"If it helps others down here on earth, Jefferson."
"Reverend Ambrose say I have to give up what's down here. Say there ain't nothing down here on earth for me no more."
"He means possessions, Jefferson. Cars, money, clothes, things like that."
"You ever seen me with a car, Mr. Wiggins?"
"No."
"With more than a dollar in my pocket?"
"No."
"More than 2 pair of shoes, Mr. Wiggins? One for Sunday, one for working in?"
"No, Jefferson."
"Then what on earth I got to give up, Mr. Wiggins?"
"You've never had any possessions to give up, Jefferson. But there is something greater than possessions, and that is love. I know you love her and would do anything for her. Didn't you eat the gumbo when you weren't hungry, just to please her? That's all we're asking for now, Jefferson. Do something to please her. Walk like a man. Meet her up there."
"Y'all asking a lot, Mr. Wiggins, from a poor old nigga who never had nothing.
She would do it for you.
She go to that chair for me, Mr. Wiggins. You? Anybody?
He waited for me to answer him. I wouldn't.
No, Mr. Wiggins. I got to go myself. Just me, Mr. Wiggins. Reverend Ambrose say God'll be there if I ask him. You think he'd be there if I ask him, Mr. Wiggins?
That's what they say, Jefferson.
You believe in God, Mr. Wiggins?
Yes, Jefferson, I believe in God.
How?
I think it's God that makes people care for people, Jefferson. I think it's God makes children play and people sing. I believe it's God that makes trees bud and food grow out of the earth.
Who make people kill people, Mr. Wiggins?
They killed his son, Jefferson.
And he never said a mumbling word.
That's what they say.
That's how I want to go, Mr. Wiggins. Not a mumbling word.
Another cowboy song was playing on the radio, but it was quiet and not disturbing. I could hear inmates down the cell block calling to one another.
I hope the time just hurry up and get here. Cut out all this waiting.
I wish I knew what to do, Jefferson.
I'm the one got to do everything, Mr. Wiggins. I'm the one.
He got up from the bunk and went to the window and looked up at the buds on the high branches of the sycamore tree. You Are My Sunshine was playing on the radio. Jefferson turned his back to the window and looked at me.
Me, Mr. Wiggins. Me. Me to take the cross. Your cross. Nan-Nan cross. My own cross. Me, Mr. Wiggins. This old stumbling nigger. Y'all ask a lot, Mr. Wiggins.
He went to the cell door and grasped it with both hands. He started to jerk the door, but changed his mind and turned back to look at me.
Whoever carried my cross, Mr. Wiggins? My mama? My daddy? They dropped me when I was nothing. Still don't know where they at this minute. I went in the field when I was 6, driving that old water cart. I pulled that cotton sack. I done cut cane, load cane. Swung that axe, chopped ditch bank since I was 6. Yes. I'm human, Mr. Wiggins. But nobody didn't know that for now. Cuss for nothing, feet for nothing, wake for nothing, grin to get by. Everybody thought that's how it's supposed to be. You too, Mr. Wiggins. You never thought I was nothing else. I didn't either. Thought I was doing what the Lord had put me on this earth to do. Now y'all want me to be better than everybody else. How, Mr. Wiggins? You tell me.
I don't know, Jefferson.
What I got left, Mr. Wiggins? 2 weeks?
I think it's something like that, if nothing happens.
Nothing's gonna happen, Mr. Wiggins. And it ain't something like that. Is all I got on this earth. I got to face that, Mr. Wiggins. It's all right for y'all to say something like that. For me, it's that. That. That's all. And like Reverend Ambrose say, then I'll have to give up this old earth. But ain't that where I'm going, Mr. Wiggins? Back in the earth?
My head down, I didn't answer him.
You can look at me, Mr. Wiggins. I don't mind.
I raised my head and I saw him standing there under the window, big and tall and not stooped as he had been in chains.
I'm gonna do my best, Mr. Wiggins. That's all I can promise, my best.
You're more of a man than I am, Jefferson.
Because I'm going to die soon. That make me a man, Mr. Wiggins.
My eyes were closed before this moment, Jefferson. My eyes have been closed all my life. Yes, we all need you, every last one of us. He studied me for a while. Then he turned his back and looked up at the window.
So pretty out there. So pretty. I ain't never seen it so pretty. What it gonna be like, Mr. Wiggins? What it gonna feel like, Mr. Wiggins?
I shook my head. I felt my eyes burning.
I hope it ain't long.
It's not long, Jefferson.
How you know, Mr. Wiggins?
I read it. It had been in the newspaper. The first jolt, if everything is right, immediately knocked a person unconscious. He came back and sat down on the bunk.
I'm all right, Mr. Wiggins. You care for a potato, Mr. Wiggins?
Sure. Jefferson's diary.
Mr. Wiggins, you say write something, but I don't know what to write, and you say I must be thinking about things I ain't telling nobody, and I ought to put it on paper, but I don't know what to put on paper, 'cause I ain't never wrote nothing but homework. I never wrote a letter in all my life, 'cause Nanay used to get other children to write her a letter and read her a letter for her, not me. So I can't think of too much to say, but maybe next time. I couldn't sleep last night, 'cause I kept dreaming it, and I don't want to dream it, 'cause I'm just walking to somewhere, but I don't know where it's at, and before I get to the door, I wake up, and I want to write in the tablet last night, but you ain't got no lighting here but the moon, so I'm writing this morning soon as sun up, but now I done forgot what I want to say. Nana brought me some Easter egg, and I had one, and Nana had one, and Reverend Ambrose, he had one. And Reverend Ambrose asked me if I know why the Lord died. And he said he died for me so I can meet him in heaven. And all he want me to do is say I want to be up there with him and the angels. And say if I mean it with all my heart and soul, I'll go to heaven. And Nana started crying again, and Miss Lou got to hug her. And Nana say all I need to do is make her life worth living is ask the Lord forgive me in the pardon of my sin. And her and Reverend Ambrose was on their knee, and Miss Lou was still in the chair hugging her, and I was glad when Paul come and got me. You look so tired sometime, Mr. Wiggins. I just feel like telling you I like you, but I don't know how to say this, 'cause I ain't never say it to nobody before, and nobody ain't never say it to me. Lord have mercy, sweet Jesus. Mr. Wiggins, where all them people come from? When you asked me if some children could come up here and speak to me, I didn't know you was meaning all them children in your class and just sitting there on the floor, all quiet, in their clean clothes looking at me. And I could see some of them were scared of me, but most was brave and spoke. And my little cousin Estelle even come up and kissed me on the jaw. And I couldn't hold it back no more. Then after the cheering, here come the old folks. And looked like everybody from the quota was here. Miss Julia and Joe and Miss Harriet and Aunt Agnes and God, now, who all? Mr. Oldfoy and Miss Feely with her beads and just praying, and all the people saying how good I look. This was the first time I cried when they locked that door behind me, the very first time. And I just sat on my bunk crying, but not let them see me or hear me, 'cause I didn't want them to think wrong, but I was crying because of Bach and the marble he gave me and for the people come to see me because they hadn't done nothing like that for me before. When they brought me in the room and I seen Nene at the table, I seen how old she looked and how tired she looked, and I told her I love her. And I told her I was strong, and she just looked old and tired and pulled me to her and kissed me. It was the first time she never done that, and it felt good. And I let her hold me long as she won't, cause you say it was good for her, and I told her I was strong, and she didn't need to come back no more, cause I was strong. And she just sat there with her eyes most shut, like she wanna go to sleep, looking at me all the time, till Reverend and Miss Lou have to help her up and take her on back home. Mr. Wiggin, when I see you girlfriend and y'all together, I see how pretty she is, and all the time I won't look at her, but scared to, cause she's so pretty and I'm so ugly, and she got on a pretty dress with pretty flowers and my clothes don't smell good and I ain't took a bath in Saturday, but I still won't look at her, and she say she think I'm looking good and strong. And when she put her hand on my shoulder, I start trembling, and she leaned close and kissed me, and I feel hot, and I could smell her powder scent, and I feel good and scared and hot, cause that's the first lady that pretty ever touched me, and nobody that pretty never kissed me. And when y'all left, I come to the door, and I looked at her long, long as I could, and could smell her powder scent, and still feel her mouth on my face. I'm sorry I cried, Mr. Wiggin. I'm sorry I cried when you say you ain't coming back tomorrow. I'm strong, and Reverend Ambrose gonna be here with me, and reason I cry, cause you've been so good to me, Mr. Wiggin, and nobody ain't never been that good to me and make me think I'm somebody. They took me and let me stand under the shower with a new bar of soap, and they gave me a big white clean towel and brought me back, and I put on some clean clothes and sat down, cause my food was here and I had every bit, and it was the best meal I know my nana ever cooked. Sun going down, and I know this the last one I'm ever gonna see, but I'm gonna see one more sunrise, cause I ain't gonna sleep tonight. I'm gonna sleep a long time after tomorrow. Sheriff Kittry come by after I ate and asked me how I'm doing, and I say I'm doing all right. And he asked me, he say, I ain't never pick up your tablet and look in it. And he asked me what all I been writing. And I told him, just things. And he say, ain't he done treat me right? And I told him, yes, sir. And he say, ain't his deputies done treat me fair? And I told him, yes, sir. And he say, ain't he done let people visit me any time? And I say, yes, sir. And he say, didn't he let the children and all the people from the quota come and visit me just 2 days ago? And I say, yes, sir. And he say, is you gonna put that in your tablet? And I say, yes, sir. And he say, good. Put that down in your tablet. I treat you good all the time you been here. And he say he had to go home, cause he hadn't had his supper yet. but for me to call a deputy if I need something. And he asked me if I want the light to stay on all night in case I want to write some more. And I told him, yes, sir. And he said, all right, I could have all the light I want. My light on, but there ain't no more light on in the place, and the place is quiet, but nobody's sleeping. I've been shaking and shaking, but I'm gonna stay strong. I ain't had no business going there with Brother and Bear, 'cause they ain't no good. And I'm going to be meeting them soon. When I was a little boy, I was a water boy and rode the cart. But now I got to be a man and sit in a chair. I can hear Randy, but I ain't listening no more, 'cause he for the living and not for me. Day breaking. Sun coming up. The bird in the tree sound like a blue bird. Sky blue. Blue, Mr. Wiggin. Goodbye, Mr. Wiggin. Tell them I'm strong. Tell them I'm a man. Goodbye, Mr. Wiggin. I'm gonna ask Paul if he can bring you this. Sincerely, Jefferson.
Sidney DeRogers was on his way to George DeRoe's house to mow the lawn when the truck went by him. He didn't pay any close attention to the black truck with the gray tarpaulin cover, but he would tell the people later at the Rainbow Club that he did feel a cold chill when the truck went by. Vivian and I sat in a corner of the Rainbow Club that night. She had gone to church after her class that afternoon, and she told me she would go again the next morning. She told me that from noon until she heard, she would have her students on their knees beside their desks. She left the Rainbow Club at 9. Thelma had closed up the cafe just after 9 and gone home. Claiborne said he was going to close up at 11 tonight. I told him I wanted a half pint to take with me. Claiborne wrapped it in a brown paper bag and I paid him, but we didn't look directly at each other. I went home. I took the bottle out of the paper bag and drank about half of it. I had bought the liquor to make me sleep, but God knows I didn't want to sleep. I didn't want to dream. Not tonight. The minister did not sleep at all that night, and at daybreak he got up and knelt beside his bed to say his prayers. Then he went to the kitchen to warm water for his bath. His wife came into the kitchen to fix him a bowl of couscous for his breakfast. When the minister finished his bath, he sat down at the table to eat. He had a cup of coffee before he ate his food. He ate very slowly as he sat at the table thinking about what he had to do today. He had chosen the 23rd Psalm to read at the jail. He had made that choice soon after the sheriff had given him permission to be one of the witnesses. Now he was reading his Bible and praying that God would give him the strength that he knew he needed. He had never witnessed anything like this before, and he knew he needed God every moment he would be there. At 6:30, the sheriff sat down to the table in his dining room to eat his breakfast. His breakfast was 2 homemade biscuit sandwiches. The biscuits had been split open. One contained a pork sausage patty, and the other contained figs. Lillian, their colored maid, had preserved figs the past summer. The sheriff also drank a glass of milk and a cup of strong coffee. He wanted to get there no later than 7:30 today because the chair was supposed to arrive by 8. He wished this day had never gotten here, but now that it had, he had to do what he had to do. This was the first time he was in charge of an execution, and he was praying that everything would go well. 2 people from Mr. Gropey's family were going to be there, and he thanked God that the family had let him handle this in a civilized way. During the month that he was in jail, Fee Jenkins' duty was to clean the sheriff's office in the white men's and the white ladies' restrooms. He started every morning between 6 and 6:30 and finished around 8 or a little after. He was just getting ready to put away the mop and the bucket when he saw them bringing that chair in through the back door. Four people were carrying it, two strangers and the two special deputies, Oscar and Claude Gurin. The sheriff walked in front. A man wearing a cowboy hat followed the chair. The man with the cowboy hat kept saying, "Be careful, be careful." He didn't want that chair bumping into anything. The sheriff opened the door to the old storeroom and the two strangers took it inside. Then everyone followed. They did not shut the door and Fee could hear them talking in there. He could hear the sheriff asking where the chair should be set, and the man in the cowboy hat was saying he wanted it against the wall, not far from the window, because those wires from the generator on the truck had to come through the window. Other people who had come to work were also in the corridor. A woman was saying that she had seen it, and it looked just gruesome. A man said it did look gruesome, and that's why they called it Gruesome Gertie. The man told the woman that whoever sat in Gruesome Gertie's lap when she was hot never sat down again. The woman replied, "That is gruesome." More people were coming in for work. They all wanted to know if the first ones there had seen it. Some of them who had not seen it said they had. Someone said if you had not seen it, you would most definitely hear it. Paul was in the office when the sheriff and the executioner, whose name was Henry Vincent, came in, followed by the two special deputies. The sheriff looked at Paul standing by the window. He told Paul where the things were. He should get Murphy out of the cell and have him do it. Vincent instructed Paul to make sure Murphy did it right, shaved him close. He pointed to areas on the leg and wrist. He said electrodes had to be attached there as well as to the head, and all that had to be shaved very clean. The sheriff told the executioner that the prisoner had hardly any hair on his body other than his head. Vincent told Paul that Murphy must shave the prisoner everywhere he told him to. Electricity sometimes found hair that the naked eye would never see. He said that this was an execution, not torture, that he had seen enough of that for a lifetime. Paul asked the sheriff if someone else couldn't do this. The sheriff told him that he had to do it. Paul and Claude went up to the cell block and unlocked Murphy's cell and told him that he had a job for him to do. Murphy looked at the things in Claude's hand and asked, "Why him?"
"Because the sheriff said so," Paul told him.
Murphy came out and the three of them went down to the last cell. Jefferson had been lying on his back, but he sat up and looked at them when they came in. He didn't seem frightened. He appeared tired. Paul could see how red his eyes were and knew that he had not slept at all. Paul asked him how he felt, and he said he was all right. He wore a blue denim shirt and denim trousers. His laceless shoes were halfway under the bunk. The radio and the notebook were on the floor beside the wall. The radio was silent. A bird sang in a sycamore tree outside the window. The two deputies watched him, but no one said anything. The bird continued its chirping in the tree outside the window. Jefferson turned to look at the deputy standing beside Paul and ask him, "How was Miss Bernice?" Claude didn't know whether he should answer until Paul nodded, and Claude told him that his wife was okay. "And little Roy?" Jefferson wanted to know. Claude looked at Paul, and Paul nodded again. "Little Roy was all right, too. He was at school." The two deputies stood back by the door and watched as the layers of hair fell to the floor. When Murphy had finished with the clippers, he dipped his hand into the basin of warm water and started rubbing Jefferson's head with a piece of white soap. Claude handed him the safety razor. When the head was shaved, black and shining, Paul instructed Murphy to take the scissors and cut Jefferson's trouser legs and shirt sleeves. He stood over Murphy and pointed out the areas around the ankles and the wrists where he wanted him to shave. All this time, Jefferson obeyed as if he were in a trance, as if he felt nothing. When Murphy was finished, he stood back and examined his work, but Jefferson was looking down at the floor. Paul asked him if he needed anything, and when he did not answer, the deputy motioned for Claude and Murphy to leave. He followed and locked the cell door. As he was about to walk away, Jefferson raised his head and looked at him. He told Paul that he wanted him to bring me the notebook and that he wanted Paul to have the radio. Paul told him he couldn't take the radio, but he would give it to the other inmates for use in the day room if Jefferson didn't mind. Jefferson continued to look at Paul, a long, deep look, and the deputy felt that there was something else he wanted to say.
Paul?
And his eyes were speaking even more than his mouth. The deputy looked back at him. Murphy and Claude did, too.
You gonna be there, Paul?
Jefferson asked. His eyes asked. Paul nodded.
Yes, Jefferson, I'll be there.
It was a nice day. Blue sky, not a cloud. Across the road in the Freeman's yard, I could see a patch of white lilies on either side of the walk that led up to the porch. An old automobile tire surrounded each flower. Behind the house was the sugarcane field. The new cane was about waist high to the average man walking between the rows. Somewhere across the field, I could hear the sound of a tractor. A white sharecropper must have been plowing the ground, since no colored people were working today. Even those who worked up at the big house for Henri Pichot or for other white people along the river had taken the day off. This had been discussed and agreed at church last Sunday. Those who were not at church were told what the others had decided, that he, Jefferson, should have all their respect this one day. What about tomorrow? What happens after today? Nothing will ever be the same after today. At 11:05, I was standing at my desk facing the opened front door when I saw the minister's car go up the quarter. I told my students to put away their things, quietly. Before letting them go, I reminded them that I didn't want any running or loud talking, and that I wanted them all back at school no later than 11:45. When they had all gone, I sat down at my desk facing the door. I did not want to think. I wanted to sit there until I heard, but not to think before then. No, I wanted to go to my car and drive away, to go somewhere and lose all memory of where I'd come from. I wanted to go. I wanted to... God, what does a person do who knows there's only one more hour to live? I felt like crying, but I refused to cry. No, I would not cry. There were too many more who would end up as he did. I could not cry for all of them, could I? But who was with him? Who was with you, Jefferson? Is he with you, Jefferson? He is with Reverend Ambrose, because Reverend Ambrose believes. Do you believe, Jefferson? Have I done anything to make you not believe? If I have, please forgive me for being a fool. For at this moment, what else is there? I know now that the old man is much braver than I. I am not with you at this moment because I would not have been able to stand. I would not have been able to walk with you those last few steps. I would have embarrassed you. But the old man will not. He will be strong. He is going to use their God to give him strength. You just watch, Jefferson. You just watch. He is brave, braver than I, braver than any of them, except you, I hope. My faith is in you, Jefferson. The children returned from dinner as I'd asked them to do. When the last one had marched into the church, I went to my desk to face them. In a couple of minutes, it will be 12:00. I will ask you to get down on your knees and remain on your knees until I ask you to get up. Are there any questions? Louis Washington Jr. raised that grimy little hand again. Is you going to bow down to Mr. Wiggins? The proper way to ask that question is, are you going to bow down to Mr. Wiggins? You going to bow down to? I'll be outside, I told the class. We need to pray? Louis Washington Jr. wanted to know. Yes, but quietly, to yourself. I took up my waistcoat and went out through the front door. I had no idea what I would do while I waited to hear from Bayonne, but I found myself out on the road and walking up the quarter. It was a couple of minutes after 12, and I was trying not to think, but how could I not think about something that had dominated my thoughts for nearly 6 months? It seemed that I had spent more time with him in that jail cell than I had with the children in the church school. Where was he at this very moment? At the window, looking out at the sky, lying on the bunk, standing up at the gray ceiling, standing at the cell door waiting. How did he feel? Was he afraid? Was he crying? Were they coming to get him now, at this moment? Was he on his knees, begging for one more minute of life? Was he standing? Why wasn't I there? Why wasn't I standing beside him? Why wasn't my arm around him? Why? Why wasn't I back there with the children? Why wasn't I down on my knees? Why? At the mouth of the quarter, there was shade from a pecan tree in the corner of the fence surrounding Henri Pichot's yard. A shallow ditch ran between the fence and the road. The people from the quarter had sat under that tree as far back as I could remember. Men had gambled there with cards and dice. Others had stood or sat there to get out of the hot sun or the rain. Before I had a car, I had stood there many times waiting for the bus. There would always be someone there, but today I sat alone. Behind me was Henri Pichot's gray and white antebellum house, sitting on its foundation high above the ground. His car was parked on the grass in the front yard. I figured that he would be the first to hear, and maybe he would come into the quarter. I looked back over my shoulder when I sat down, and I looked back every minute or two afterward. It must have been 12:15 by now. I didn't want to look at my watch anymore. Had it already happened, or was he still waiting, sitting on the bunk, hands clasped together, waiting? Was he standing at the cell door, listening for the first sound of footsteps coming toward him? Or was it finally over? Don't tell me to believe. Don't tell me to believe in the same God or laws that men believe in who commit these murders. Don't tell me to believe that God can bless this country and that men are judged by their peers. Who among his peers judged him? Was I there? Was the minister there? Was Farrell Giroux? Was my aunt? Was Vivian? No, his peers did not judge him, and I will not believe. Yet they must believe. They must believe, if only to free the mind, if not the body. Only when the mind is free has the body a chance to be free. Yes, they must believe. They must believe, because I know what it means to be a slave. I am a slave. Several feet away from where I sat under the tree was a hill of bull grass. I doubted that I had looked at it once in all the time I had been sitting there. I probably would not have noticed it at all had a butterfly, a yellow butterfly with dark specks like ink dots on its wings, not lit there. What had brought it there? There was no odor that I could detect to have attracted it. There were other places where it could have rested. There was the wire fence on either side of the road. There were the weeds along the ditches with strong fragrances. There were flowers just a short distance away in Pichot's yard. So why did it light on a hill of bullgrass that offered it nothing? I watched it closely, the way it opened its wings again, fluttered, closed its wings for a second or two, then opened them again and flew away. I watched it fly over the ditch and down into the quarter. I watched it until I could not see it anymore. Yes, I told myself, it is finally over. Just before going into the churchyard, I looked back up the quarter, and now I did see a car coming toward me. The driver drove slowly to keep down the dust. I moved into the ditch as Paul came up even with me and stopped. We looked at each other, and I knew he had come to bring me the news. I didn't go up to the car as I was supposed to do. I waited for him to make his move. I saw him reach for something on the seat beside him. Then he opened the door and got out. He had a notebook, just like the one I had given Jefferson. I waited for him to come to me.
He wanted me to bring you this.
Paul looked directly at me, his gray-blue eyes more intense than I had ever seen them before. I took the notebook from him, and he continued to stare at me like someone in shock.
Do you have a minute?
he asked me. Paul and I started walking down the quarter. We were both quiet. I waited for him to begin.
It went as well as it could have gone.
He spoke slowly as we walked abreast. He looking up ahead, I down at the ground.
There was no trouble. He was a little shaky, but no trouble.
Paul was quiet a moment, then suddenly he stopped walking. After going another step, I stopped too and looked back at him.
He was the strongest man in that crowded room, Grant Wiggins,
Paul said.
He was. He was. And I'm not saying this to make you feel good. I'm not saying this to ease your pain. Ask the preacher. He was the stronger man there. We all stood jammed together, no more than 6-8 feet away from that chair. We all had each other to lean on. When Vincent asked him if he had any last words, he just looked at the preacher and said, "Tell Nan Nan I walked." And straight he walked, Grant Wiggins. I'm a witness. Straight he walked.
Paul stopped talking. He was breathing heavily. He was looking at me, but seeing Jefferson in that chair. We started walking again. We were passing by Miss Emma's house, but Paul didn't know this. He had never been in the quarter before.
After they put the death cloth over his face, I couldn't watch anymore. I looked down at the floor. I heard the two jolts, but I wouldn't look up. I'll never forget the sound of that generator as long as I live on this earth.
We came to the end of the quarter and stood on the railroad tracks while gazing across the field at the rows of early cane. Paul got in front of me to look in my face.
You're one great teacher, Grant Wiggins,
he said. I'm not great. I'm not even a teacher.
Why do you say that?
You have to believe to be a teacher, I said, looking at the rows of new cane. To the right of where we were standing were the tall pecan trees in the cemetery. There would be another grave there within a day or two.
I saw the transformation, Grant Wiggins.
I didn't do it.
Who then?
Maybe he did it himself.
He never could have done that. I saw the transformation. I'm a witness to that.
Then maybe it was God. Paul continued to look at me. He did not like the way I'd used the name of God. He came from good stock. He believed, but he didn't say anything. You ready to start back? I asked him.
I didn't open his notebook,
Paul said. We had turned and were walking up the quarter now.
I didn't think it was my place to open the notebook. He asked me to bring it to you, and I brought it to you. But I would like to know his thoughts sometime, if you don't mind.
After I read it, I said.
I suppose this has been very hard on everybody.
Hard on people here.
School is just about ready to end, huh?
Yes, I said. We start a month later and get out 2 months earlier than the whites do.
If I could ever be of any help, I would like you to call on me. I mean that with all my heart.
We were passing by Miss Emma's house. Reverend Ambrose's car was parked before the door.
Isn't that the preacher's car?
Paul asked. That's where Jefferson lived. That's his Nan-Nan's house.
Paul looked at the house as we went by.
He looked at it again over his shoulder. We came up to the church and stopped at his car. Well, I better go in to the children.
Paul stuck out his hand. Allow me to be your friend, Grant Wiggins. I don't ever want to forget this day. I don't ever want to forget him.
I took his hand. He held mine with both of his.
I don't know what you're going to say when you go back in there. But tell them he was the bravest man in that room today. I'm a witness, Grant Wiggins. Tell them so.
Maybe one day you will come back and tell them so.
It would be an honor.
I turned from him and went into the church. I told the class to rise with their shoulders back. I went up to the desk and turned to face them. I was crying.